You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is someday in either February or March. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live-ish in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what day it is. I'm not even 100% sure what month it is. Could be March. Could be February. Probably March. So what am I doing here? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not here. We have pre-recorded this intro in the event that, well, not in the event, for when the inevitable event of the birth of my second child takes place. And because you're hearing it, it means that I am on paternity leave. How long will it be? Probably not that long. I may take a little more time later, but for the next day or two or three or four, maybe five, depending on which day you're listening to this, we will have a series of either guest hosts or pre-recorded interviews that we've done, or archive shows. And in just a moment, you will hear the dulcet tones of Matt and Michael, the Majority Report producers, who will explain whether it's a guest host or some archived interviews from the first Majority Report or from this version of the Majority Report, or interviews that I pre-recorded over the past couple of weeks, or interviews done by some of my friends. Not to say that Michael and Matt aren't my friends. I'm friendly with them. But let's not get carried away. So I leave it now to Matt and Michael to give you the information. They'll tell you what the date is. They'll tell you what the status is of the birth of my second child. And they'll let you know what to expect on today's program. So see you soon.
It is March 7th. This is the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks.
And I am Matt Binder.
Filling in for the illustrious Sam Cedar because Baby Cedar has arrived.
Yes, sirree. 5:36 this morning, Baby Filibuster Cedar was born. And
that's actually not it. In fact, the baby doesn't have a name.
Baby
yet.
Does not have, not even Saul.
Not even Saul made the final cut. We're still waiting anxiously on the final name of the baby. But hopefully you're in capable hands today, Majority Report listeners.
Hopefully.
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 The audacity of hope.
I would say the first success of today is that we are actually broadcasting live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
That's absolutely the first success
of the day. If you could play the shofar, you'd play the shofar.
And that was the first failure of the day. All right, let's move into the first story of the day. I think that Boss Cedar would approve of this because we talk a lot about too big to fail banks, bank monopolies, banks not being prosecuted for doing things like laundering drug money. And it just so happens that in testimony, I think it was yesterday, in front of the Senate Banking Committee, excuse me, the Senate Judiciary Committee and Oversight, Attorney General Eric Holder acknowledged that some banks may in fact be too big to fail, too big to prosecute.
Uh-huh.
Which is very interesting. This is sort of a direct acknowledgement. So this is in response to a question from Senator Chuck Grassley.
Good old Grassley, the king of Twitter.
Grassley's actually good on this stuff, oddly. I mean, not legislatively, but he's good at asking the occasional good question.
And he's amazing at Twitter.
Why is he so amazing at Twitter?
Because he's so terrible at it.
Oh, is he the guy who has, like, he misspells everything and has bizarre
pocket tweets, and he talks about constantly hitting deer on the road, and it's pretty amazing.
That's really – okay. I didn't realize he did the whole hitting deer thing on the road. That's amazing. All right. All right. So this is Attorney General Holder in response to a question from Chuck Grassley. Grassley's asking, is there a slippery slope with banks where some banks are too big – there's a slippery slope where some banks are too big to jail, too big to prosecute. And Attorney General Holder said, quote, I'm concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them. When we're hit with indications that if you prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy, Holder said, according to The Hill. And I think that it's a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large. So there's nothing new here, folks. I think what it was that first these institutions became too large. And as they were becoming too large, they were deregulated. So we took what should be fundamentally an incredibly boring and necessary business, which is banking, getting liquidity in the market, helping people, facilitate investment, loans, and things like that. And it became this creative and dangerous deregulated enterprise. And we're still living with the consequences of that. Senator Elizabeth Warren still showing that she's at least rhetorically so far doing exactly what she campaigned on, which is great, said in response to Holder's testimony, quote, it's been almost 5 years since the financial crisis, but the big banks are still too big to fail. That means they're subsidized by about $83 billion a year by American taxpayers and are still being held – and are still not being held fully accountable for breaking the law. Attorney General Holder's testimony that the biggest banks are too big to fail, too big to jail, shows once again that it is past time to end too big to fail. And actually, the other day I saw Nassim Taleb, who's kind of a controversial financial writer. He said the other day, and I'm not looking at the camera. I apologize. Here I am. He said the other day that that bankers who work in subsidized banks should all receive the same salary as government workers and civil servants since they're subsidized by our tax dollars. That seemed pretty logical and sensible to me. Look, coming up, even with a freshly arrived baby, Sam still did an excellent interview for us with Bill Black, who's a law professor, finance expert, and he did an interview on why austerity is still being pushed in the United States after we've seen what utter havoc and failure it's left in its wake across Europe as they've pushed austerity. This is about a 20-minute interview or so. We're going to go right into it, and then we'll be back with more Binder and Brooks. Mission accomplished. I've wanted Toots and the Maytales to be played on this show for a long, long time. And now, folks, an interview Sam did with Professor Bill Black on austerity. Ooh.
So, Bill, one of the questions that I get asked on a regular basis is, how is it that this notion of imposing austerity, when we have seen what it has done to Europe, how is it that it is so embraced by the establishment in this country as well? In many respects, we have plenty of examples of that. Where does this? Well, first off, let's talk about this. Would you describe the austerity that we hear, this fixation on the debt, this demand that it be considered a crisis when in fact we have a jobs crisis in this country? Would you consider it an ideology?
Oh, yeah, it is the essence of dogma. But the pernicious part about it, in fairness, is that we tend to extrapolate from what we know best. And so as a consumer, what do we know best? We know ourselves and a household. And for a household, well, if we get into debt, of course we can't issue more money and debt very easily. And so the answer frequently is for us to really cut our expenditures dramatically and maybe work an extra job and such, certainly pay off all the high-cost credit card debt, right? Those are all sensible things for a consumer. And so people extrapolate and say, what's sensible for a consumer, for an individual household, well, that must make sense for a nation as well. And no, that's where it breaks down completely. A government, particularly a government with a sovereign currency like the United States, is nothing like a household. And if it behaves like a household and adopts austerity, it will make the recession vastly worse and will often increase the debt instead of reducing the debt. So it's the worst of all worlds. It's a lose-lose-lose proposition. You lose all the benefits from the spending that you're cutting, and you lose the economic growth, and you even end up losing in the sense of creating more debt because you throw the nation into recession. So the fundamental thing people don't understand is that we have a huge deficit, although actually it's fallen dramatically, because not because we spent too much, but because we had the Great Recession. And when you have the Great Recession, incomes fall dramatically, wealth falls, and so income tax revenues, property tax revenues, sales tax revenues, they all go down dramatically, and expenditures go up because more people are unemployed, more people are in poverty, more people are going hungry and such. What we learned, or at least we thought we had learned, was the benefit of automatic stabilizers. And these work against the business cycle, so we call them countercyclical, and they make the recessions far less severe. And since nations of the world, not just the United States, adopted these automatic stabilizers over 50 years ago, recessions have been much milder and recoveries have been much quicker than the historical average. But as you said, an ideology that's come into play where a particular party in the U.S. context, it's the Republican Party, want to use austerity to destroy social programs because they're working so well.
What in the context of the United States, what are the automatic stabilizers?
So the automatic stabilizers are that the income tax is progressive. And that means that when times are really good, the marginal rates are higher and much more tax revenue comes in, which will tend to keep the boom from getting to be too big a boom and producing inflation. And when you have recession, it works the other way around. Less and less income is in those higher marginal tax brackets, so income revenues fall very substantially. And simultaneously, programs like unemployment insurance and food stamps and Medicaid all increase their funding of people when they most need it. And again, this is a win-win where you get vital public services to the people who most need it, and it actually helps the economy recover and actually reduces the debt over time by producing the greater growth.
And so now, with that said, there's a there's another, well, I wouldn't call it quite automatic, but there seems to be a semi-automatic response to crisis moments like this, and that is the rise of these austerians, if you want to call them that. It is the rise in many respects. It is the sort of the dynamic is outlined in Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. When we suffer a recession like this, there is, like you said, for those who are not enmeshed in economics, there is an automatic response that the government should tighten its belt as well, just like families. And so the in comes these austerians, and in the context of our country, this impulse is driven by, frankly, billionaires. Pete Peterson, in particular, is one of them, isn't he?
He is, but it's even a little nastier than what you've said, because it turns out when Republicans are the president, they use all kinds of fiscal stimulus. They run huge deficits, and it produces a prompter recovery. It's only when Democrats are presidents that they suddenly adopt austerity as this near religion. And the reason they do that is exactly your point about Pete Peterson, who has made no bones about the fact that his enemy is the safety net and that his mission in life, this is a conservative Republican Wall Streeter who has vowed to use his personal wealth of up to $1 billion to gut the safety net. And in particular, what he wants is the great dream of every Republican financier, and actually many Democratic financiers as well, and that is to begin to privatize Social Security so that Wall Street can earn fees off of investing those retirement funds. So that's the great dream, and as I say, it is asymmetrical. They actually quiet the Pete Petersons will actually quiet down a great deal under the Republicans and become apoplectic when Democrats are in charge.
Yeah, it's fascinating because if you actually Google around and look for Pete Peterson's claims of the fiscal nightmare that is just around the corner. They exist during the 90s, and then all of a sudden they go away for about 8 years, and then they come back in time for the next Democrat to be president. We've got to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to talk about how this Washington consensus was formed, and you have a piece in Alternate, which shows that in many respects, what the attempts by the Pete Peterson funded organizations are doing now is based on, in many ways, the model that was forged at a time when Latin America was going through a genuine debt crisis, and their creditors in the United States or the World Bank or the IMF were in a position to extract certain concessions from them. We'll talk about that in just a moment when we return. So, Bill, when we broke, we had talked about the reasons why austerity at this point in our economy can be disastrous, and it's the and the reasons why, frankly, why it is somewhat intuitive to believe that government should be cutting back on its spending at a time when our economic situation is underperforming, I should say. And in fact, that's exactly the opposite of what we're doing. But we've also talked about the agendas of those people who rush in at a time like this and attempt to impose their notions, their fantasies of austerity, which, of course, in some ways, that is just half of the coin. The other half of that is that it would cause essentially a lot of money that is now provided and redistributed, if you want to say, across all of the income spectrums, to be privatized and wind up in the hands of some very wealthy people, particularly on Wall Street. Talk about John Williamson and what you outline in this piece in Alternate as to how this austerity play played out in the 1980s.
Sure. Although let me do one plug first. Our blog at UMKC Economics is New Economic Perspectives, and all of these pieces are on New Economic Perspectives. As you said, John Williamson was the person who coined the term Washington Consensus and who did the big paper setting out the 10 provisions of the Washington Consensus. And the introduction to that paper says this is all about the quid pro quo in debt collection. You know, we'll extend the debts of the Latin American nations a bit, but only if they give us these 10 things in return. And number one on the list was austerity. And Williamson was already working for the Peterson Institute and still works for the Peterson Institute. And as you said, one of the other key provisions was privatization. And this is the reason that Carlos Slim, which may not be a name familiar to most Americans, is, depending on the day in the list, the wealthiest person in the world because of the privatization of the Mexican phone system. So if you have a situation, which the consensus people said, there's a weak government, lots of corruption, what's going to happen if you sell the crown jewels of the nation? They're going to sell them to their cronies at, you know, ridiculously low prices. And so it was a tremendous transfer of wealth from the peoples of the Americas to whatever the wealthiest oligarchs were. And the whole system was supposed to produce massive increase in growth, and instead it produced very poor results, such that you've seen one left-oriented leader after another elected in Latin America on the explicit platform, elect me and I will stop this Washington consensus. So we've seen the failure that it has produced in the Americas. We've seen the failure that it's produced in Europe, where the Eurozone as a whole has been forced back into a completely gratuitous recession by this austerity program, where nations like Greece and Spain and Italy are not in recession, they're in Great Depression levels of unemployment, which is tearing these countries apart. You've just seen the Italian elections and the reaction of the stock markets to all of this and such, so that the euro has become the greatest threat to European solidarity and to the European people because it was, you know, it's an oxymoron that was developed by regular morons, and it's now made worse by this stupidity of this austerity regime, which is pushed all these nations to a situation where, well, let's take their one supposed success story. Their one supposed success story is Latvia, which has lost more than 10% of its population because people can't get jobs. Imagine what their unemployment rate would be if that 10% had stayed. That's their supposed success story. And by the way, for the other 90% that have remained, real wages have been slashed. So we call this the road to Bangladesh strategy, where you put each nation in competition with each other to lower working wages. And, of course, they call this reform, because that's a useful word. And the reform is we get rid of any protections for workers.
And we should say that the euro, it is because these nations don't have a sovereign currency, because they are locked into the valuation of the euro, is why, which is one of the primary, aside from the fact that we have far more diverse economy, that's one of the primary reasons why we will never become Greece, because we do have the capacity to control our own currency.
That is correct. They gave up the essential attribute of sovereignty when they gave up their own currencies. And so when you're in a really severe recession, you have three primary strategies to get out of it. They're not mutually exclusive. You can do all of them at the same time. You can have a really aggressive monetary policy. You can have a very aggressive fiscal policy. That would be stimulus. And you can devalue your currency. But, of course, you can't devalue your currency because you don't have a currency anymore. And you can't have an aggressive monetary policy because the European Central Bank is completely controlled by German ideology against any aggressive monetary policy. And they've made illegal, through their oxymoronic stability and growth pact, which actually produces instability and recession, they made it illegal to have a significant stimulus program. So what they've mandated is that you shoot yourself, not just in the foot, but a whole lot farther up your anatomy. And the only exception, this is actually what they claim, they tell people they should do, is that they should get in a competition to reduce their wages relative to other nations. Well, what if we all do that?
It's a race down, and I guess that there are certain, frankly, the industrialists, then their profits continue to rise, I guess, in some respects. But we just have a minute left here.
And that's in Europe and the United States, by the way, that's exactly what's happened. Massive rise in corporate profits and real wages stalled or lowered.
And you know, now this is the $64 million question here. And do you think... And we just have a minute. And so, I mean, it may be an impossible task to answer this question. But how much of this is, when we have this austerian ideology in this country, how much of it is driven simply by greed, and how much of it is just driven simply by stupidity? I mean, it's the age-old question. Evil or stupid? Is it? Can you give me a breakdown?
Worse than that. They see this as their only way to attack the most successful and popular programs in America that are the key legacy of the Democratic Party, the safety net.
Easy enough. So I guess that's evil, but at the same time, they don't realize that they're shooting themselves in the foot long term, because those programs didn't just develop out of thin air. They were developed out of necessity. Bill Black, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. They hate that which works.
Indeed.
All right. That was hot. All right. Cool. We're up.
You're up.
All right. Great. All right, folks. That was William Black with Sam Cedar. Sam Cedar talking to William Black. Great interview that Sam prepared for all of you, even with his baby on the way. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's a really compelling reason to become a member.
Put your volume up a bit.
How am I now?
Good.
There's something about volumes and me on this show. It's never been smooth.
It's all good. I understand.
How's that?
Good. Is the levels peaking on there? You see where it goes green? Mm-hmm. Does it ever hit red?
No.
All right. Perfect.
Get a little inside baseball there, guys. Does it ever go red?
Does it ever go red, folks? Does it ever go red? All right. Let's continue on with today's show, shall we?
So,
by the way, I'm Matt Binder. For those who are watching on YouTube, I will be hosting this portion of the show with Michael Brooks, who's sitting behind the soundboard there.
Sitting behind like a monkey at NORAD. I have no idea what I'm doing here.
I think monkeys at NORAD know a bit more, actually.
Probably. They're more confident. So Matt, when he came in this morning, was fuming.
I was fuming, yes. I was fuming. I was very angry.
About Rand Paul.
You want to get to
Rand
Paul?
He's pissed.
All right, yes. I'm fuming about Rand Paul.
Well, so break it down. Why?
All right, so... For those who weren't paying attention yesterday, Rand Paul filibustered the Brennan confirmation. And he went for 13 hours, which 13 hours, yes. Michael sighs over there. And in his 13-hour filibuster, he went. It was what filibusters are meant to be. It was policy talk. He wasn't reading from a phone book or, you know, reading his mom's recipes or something. It was a filibuster as filibusters should be. And I have to hand it to Rand Paul. I will give him credit. He's the only one who's questioned this administration about their use of drone strikes on American citizens. Okay. So a lot of people were giving Rand Paul way too much credit, I think, though. Sam yesterday actually gave Rand Paul credit. He said it was the one time he'll agree with him, you know, everyone like a broken clock, you know, right at least twice a day.
Right, but right. And Rand Paul broken clock. I get that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sam actually got some hit from people on Twitter, I guess you can say.
He got hits. Why?
People. Emo prog stuff.
Stuff. So you got to. I don't know if everybody knows this, but some people basically attack Sam for being what's called an emo prog, which I guess means he's like an emotional indie musician progressive. Is that what it means?
That's what it is. An emotional indie musician progressive. Yeah. Sam is literally Ben Gibbard.
I don't know who Ben Gibbard is.
From Death Cab for Cutie.
I listen
and Postal
to Nas,
Service.
Man. I don't know.
I got it. Okay, stuff. So let's get all back
right,
to
so
Rand
anyway,
Paul.
So Rand Paul, but it was really interesting. You did not like that particularly progressives were praising Rand Paul, even though you agreed with what Rand Paul was saying. I think it is interesting. So what made you angry?
Okay, what pisses me off about what progressives were saying, progressives were hailing Rand Paul, you know, at least he's brave enough to stand up there. At least Rand Paul is the one doing something about this. You know, if you don't like what Rand Paul is doing, you're showing that you're a partisan hack. You know, you're only for the Democrats, which is not true. I mean, Rand Paul is only doing this because he's Rand Paul. It's his brand. He doesn't really care about drone strikes. He does care about drone strikes in terms of, the executive branch doing it. He cares that Barack Obama can drone strike you. He cares. You know what? He would even care about George Bush drone striking you. It's not Republican or Democrat matter, Rand Paul. It's a matter of big government. I guarantee you that if a state passed some law where their police departments could drone strike a criminal who they're currently chasing on the highway, he would be fine with that.
That would be an interesting question to ask Rand Paul. You're calling Rand. So basically what you're saying is Rand Paul's sort of like right for the wrong reasons. And like a lot of the people that call up this show, he has absolutely insane and ludicrous views about states' rights. So his issue is not with drone strikes per se. It's who's doing them. So if the state of Alabama reinstituted slavery and then used drones to enforce that rule, he would be fine with it. That's what you're saying.
In fact, Rand Paul is for drones in terms of protecting our borders. I mean, I assume he doesn't mean sending armed drones down there to, you know, blow up an illegal immigrant.
But to monitor people.
Yes, but to monitor people. Yeah. But you know what? His argument also includes the whole, but if we let them do this, how far will it go? If we let a drone monitor our border, how far until we start blowing up people who's crossing our border who we think are it's part of the drug trafficking trade here in this country.
No, that's a good question. So, do we have sound of Rand Paul?
We do. Let's start with this Rand Paul sound. Let's play a little
Rand Paul sound so you get a flavor of what he sounded like yesterday.
Do you want to put up the computer over there? It's labeled computer. Just put it. Here we go.
Hold on.
One second.
Am I the right thing up?
You have the computer up?
I have the same thing up that I had for the interview.
Okay, that's good.
Okay.
Nope, it's the one labeled computer.
Sorry, folks. Technical difficulty here. All right.
Nope, that's not it. It should be next to it. Let's just skip the sound. We don't really need it.
Wait, I think this is it. I think I got it. Play the sound.
Nope.
I don't have it? All right.
No.
Forget it. Sorry, folks. But anyways, I think that that's an interesting point. But I think that the other really big thing here that I think you're pointing to is basically as long as we have issues like this, like drones and like due process and like kill lists and all. And actually, I should say, I think, you know, Ron Wyden, who was a Democrat, obviously, he spoke during the filibuster, supported Rand Paul's filibuster. So there has been a few people besides Rand Paul have kind of highlighted this issue. But I think the really big problem is, and you saw this during Ron Paul's campaign, that if the only people who are going to come out and speak a certain way on certain issues are these really far-right extreme libertarians, then these issues get polluted. Like that guy Jim, who calls up, you know, or used to call up all the time until maybe it doesn't seem like he calls anymore. But he used to call up all the time, and it was always this sort of one-sided thing about drones, which I think is a – you know, I sometimes actually question why people get so singularly focused on drones. I think that it can get overemphasized at a certain point. But it is a really important issue. It's an important thing to figure out.
And then I'm not saying that there isn't any value in what Rand Paul did. For sure. There's value in what Rand Paul did. In fact, it sparked the drone conversation. But what I'm saying is people think, you know, Rand Paul might have these ideas and these principles on this, that, and this that I don't agree with. But, you know, he's standing up for the Constitution and what's right. And, I mean, what Rand Paul's doing is he's out for Rand Paul. And I know people might not agree with that, but, I mean, yesterday, what was being talked about online? What was the hashtag they used? It wasn't, you know, filibuster or drones. The hashtag that was going around on Twitter all day was stand with Rand. This was all about Rand Paul. And when conservatives talk about, look at Ron Paul making the founders proud and upholding the Constitution, they're not talking about the drone issue in particular. They're talking about Rand Paul just standing up to Barack Obama on any issue. This could have been about anything, and they would have been like, oh, look what Rand Paul is doing. This is great. The only reason it got bigger than just in that conservative world is because a lot of progressives and a lot of people in general don't agree with the drone policy, especially when it comes to American citizens.
Well, I think what I was saying is I think the problem is that if a guy like Rand Paul is going to be the most high profile spokesperson on an issue like this, that's really intrinsically problematic, because that's why you see kids showing up at colleges to, you know, hear like his dad talk, or maybe potentially him now after this kind of breakout moment, to hear about drones or to hear about war, to hear about the other things that they're concerned about and other people aren't speaking to in the same way. And then all this other garbage gets shoveled in the same way. Like, oh, you know, maybe the Civil Rights Act wasn't such a good idea, or maybe we should all buy gold, or maybe the, you know, Violence Against Women Act, you know, isn't something we should be voting on. I think that's a big problem. Where I disagree with you a little bit, though, is I don't know if this is really what Rand Paul needs for his career. It depends on what he wants to do. I think he wants to run for president potentially, and I think he wants to play a more mainstream role in Republican politics than his dad did. And I think right now, because of what you're saying, you're absolutely right, that because it's perceived as standing up against President Obama, he'll get traction from it. A couple years down the line in a Republican primary, and everybody's, you know, fear-mongering and trying to out-demagogue the issue, national security, terrorism, dropping bombs on people, I think some of the things he said yesterday could come back to haunt him. In a Republican primary. I mean, talking very specifically. The fact that he forced a woman to worship Aqua Buddha and got her high could come back to haunt
him. This is a guy who everyone's hailing on, oh, civil liberty, civil libertarian. This is the guy who was against the Ground Zero Mosque. He was the one who was outspoken about it. He even broke from his own dad on this issue. He went out and he said, you know, if the imam of that Ground Zero Mosque and the Islamic people want to honor those of 9/11, they should donate. They should donate to some 9/11 memorial. How dare they go and make a mosque anywhere near Ground Zero? This is ridiculous. This guy is principled when principled matters to him. I mean, just look at the people who stood up with him yesterday.
This will help him in a Republican primary. The whole Ground Zero Mosque thing, that might be what he has to push.
I mean, just look at some of the people who stood up with him during this filibuster. Ted Cruz, you know what Ted Cruz went up there for? Ted Cruz wants to lead the Tea Party, just like Rand Paul wants to lead the Tea Party. Ted Cruz saw Rand Paul getting all this PR and doing wonders for his brand by doing this filibuster, standing up as a civil libertarian. Ted Cruz said, I want in on that action. That's what Ted Cruz was there for. Marco Rubio stood up there, and he – Marco Rubio around midnight last night started quoting Wiz Khalifa, Jay-Z, and The Godfather. Yes, Marco Rubio. You know what Marco Rubio is trying to do? Marco Rubio was basically up there going to himself, you know, I don't quite agree with Rand Paul on this whole drone issue. We should use drones, but the kids really like what Rand Paul's spewing, so I'm going to come up here and give the kids what else they like.
I don't even know that Marco Rubio knows what the drone program is. Really.
Yeah, I don't think
he
knows either.
It doesn't seem like something he'd be that engaged with.
Mitch McConnell showed up. Mitch McConnell showed up just before midnight, and what happened there is I'm sure Mitch McConnell's staffers were seeing all the PR Rand Paul was getting, and Mitch McConnell staffers probably gave Mitch McConnell a call and told him, hey, Mitch, you better get him down here. And Mitch McConnell popped his head out of his turtle shell and waddled down to the Senate floor. You know, when has Mitch McConnell ever stood up on an issue like this?
And can I just say that this is what Matt's like in the morning. He orchestrates the entire show. Sam and I sit, I pull some stories, Sam's getting prepped, and Matt's just like, this is what needs to be covered. All right, everybody, listen up. Shut the F up.
And you know what? To show that this isn't partisan or anything, let's talk about the Democrats who stood up there. Ron Wyden. That's it. Ron Wyden is the one Democrat who went up there to take part in this. Where were the progressive Democrats? Where was Bernie Sanders? Where was Elizabeth Warren? Dick Durbin stood up there to ask questions. You know what Dick Durbin gave? He gave a straw man argument about 9/11. You know, should we, you know, what would happen if that fourth airplane on 9/11 wasn't taken down by the people who were on the flight and the president had to strike that airplane down? You have to let him kill those citizens, those American citizens on the plane. That's why you have to let this happen. And Rand Paul, to his credit, constantly told him, no one's debating an issue like that. No one's debating that if America is under attack by another American, should we not have to, and there's no other way to stop this attack, that we have to do this. That wasn't what he was debating, even though I even have differences on Rand Paul on that.
What do you mean?
I don't think we should ever, no matter what.
You wouldn't take down an airplane?
Absolutely not. Not if American citizens were on it.
Wow. I don't.
No.
I,
that's my personal opinion.
All right. Well, I totally disagree with you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I mean.
Like totally.
Okay, well, that's fine.
But I think that's a really important thing, because what you're saying is totally right. So, and that's actually what was in the Holder letter. So I think what sparked this was that Rand Paul wanted a specific answer from the Attorney General, which is whether the United States reserved the right to use a drone or assassinate an American citizen on American soil. And the response from Holder basically was like, well, that's not ideally what we would like to do. However, there are these situations, and then he named a situation like the fourth plane, where which pretty much everybody besides Matt Binder, I guess. But I think that's a really important point, because he didn't answer Rand Paul's question. He didn't get to the issue that he was saying. He wasn't saying, if someone has commandeered an airplane, do you reserve the right to take it down? He was saying, do you reserve the right to, drop a drone on somebody who you know is a terrorist, but maybe is, on their way to lunch?
Should we be able to drone strike Jane Fonda if she was sitting in a cafe drinking coffee?
That was it. It started to get off the rails a little bit. The guy was speaking for 13 hours, so he also did a really uncomfortable and bizarre Hitler analogy at one point, which wasn't doing him any favors.
Well,
but I think
you know what I feel about that. I mean, all right. Before we go to the better half, I just want to talk about one more thing about.
Yeah,
all
please
this.
Go ahead.
Ted Cruz's hypothetical story was absolutely hilarious.
Great.
And we have to just mention it. I mean, it's hilarious. Ted Cruz was up there late at night. He got up there to give Rand Paul a little bit of a break, which I guess kind of goes against that whole Ayn Rand individualism thing. I mean,
you're
looks like
calling
some,
out Rand
that's
a, Paul.
That's some collectivist filth, if you ask me. Getting help from somebody in your filibuster, but I mean,
what a team player in a bad way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Come on now. I mean, but okay, let's get to Ted Cruz's hypothetical analogy. So Ted Cruz is up there, and sometime during the night, he also somehow talked about gay marriage being bad. How that came up, I have no idea. But let's get to this hypothetical story.
See, when you have drone strikes and Obama can use drones, then the gays get married.
Exactly.
I could do hashtag
exactly.
Tea Party logic. Okay.
Exactly.
And Muslims. All right, go ahead.
So this hypothetical story is basically, Ted Cruz says, you know, what we did to bin Laden is right. However, that's because behind enemy lines, things are different. You can't pick and choose whether you could capture someone or kill someone. You have to just get in there and get the job done. However, what if bin Laden was sitting in a cafe drinking coffee, or, you know, wasn't an imminent threat, and he went up to his apartment building in this in Chicago. His apartment building in Chicago, yes. And he was sleeping. Can we drop a drone on him then? Bin Laden sleeping in an apartment building in Chicago was the analogy here.
I wonder why he picked Chicago, like of all the
cities. Because of Dick Durbin.
So Dick Durbin.
Yes.
That's actually, you know, that's interesting. I think that might also hurt Ted Cruz in a Republican primary, because the answer would be yes, of course, in a Republican primary.
Well, you know what's probably happened? It's probably on, or was probably on Alex Jones radio right now. He's probably
what's going on,
so,
Alex?
You know, U.S. Senator, you know, he was doing at the Senate hearing and the filibuster that Rand Paul was doing, and this Senator Ted Cruz, he said, you know, the guy we got in the suburbs of Pakistan, he wasn't Osama bin Laden. Remember, the pictures have never been released. This was all, you know, this was all to make Obama look good. What's really true, and Ted Cruz came out and said it yesterday, he said it. Osama bin Laden himself is sleeping in an apartment in Chicago. That's where he is right now.
You can't make this up, folks.
You cannot make this up. And don't forget, while you're looking for Osama bin Laden, drinking in that cafe in Chicago, don't forget to buy my DVDs.
Ooh, look at that. Matt coming through with a pretty solid Alex Jones impression. I think you did the Southern. He's a little bit less Southern than that, but that was really good.
Thank you. Thank you. I tried my best there.
That was, which was great, which is perfect. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the show. We have many things coming up for you. I also would just like to say, I don't care. You know, libertarians, if you think that you can, you know, sneak your way in on today's show because Sam's in here to decimate you, I'll gladly step into his place. Matt will gladly step into his place. We'll take you on. We'll take any of you on, basically anywhere, any place, anytime, any place. So I just want to put that challenge right up front. That's number one. Look, Shylock Hugo Fidel Castro Cedar has arrived. He's been born. Sam's new son is here. And really would be a great time to support this show, to become a member, to buy things for our through our Amazon link. Again, that doesn't do anything for you, but it does a whole lot for us. Like us on Twitter and Facebook.
Wow,
get
Michael's
the word
on.
Out. Oh. Get the word
I don't
out.
Have to say anything right now.
I'm like.
I'll just keep back and
I'm like PT.
Oh,
Barnum
by the way,
right
by
now.
The way, before we go to the, you can play the music. But before we go, Sam Cedar has not named his child yet. So keep those baby names coming. We do not have a baby name yet. Do you believe that?
I actually kind of saw this coming.
It's amazing.
It's expected.
Phil Ibuster Cedar.
That's a really bad idea.
All right, folks. Stay tuned for the better half of the program. Let's give the number here, 646-257-3920. The conservative line, as Sam Cedar likes to call it, is 646-257-3920. Libertarians, that line's open as well. That is 646-257-3920.
And we'll take you on. We don't care.
Yeah, let's do it.
The IMs are on.
Bring it.
Bring it. We just talked about too big to fail banks, you fools. See you in the second and better half of the show.